Hello, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 17 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. In today's episode, Justin and I talk about hope and despair, especially as it relates to political systems through the lens of Ephesians, as we concluded the conversation about his dissertation. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week.
I don't have anything special for coffee this morning. Is this something that we should discuss? Because I feel like I'm getting boring when I start saying, hey, I'm drinking a Caribou iced coffee this morning.
Well, okay, so then what's the best coffee you've had recently?
Yeah, it's kind of boring too.
It's such a big cup. I just saw the cup that you're drinking out of. We don't have cups that big here.
And this is a large.
It looks so big. Is that
this
a large?
This is not an extra large, which is even bigger.
It exists though, an extra large does?
Oh yeah. Oh, it exists. This is large.
It's funny the things I've gotten used to.
Now, even if I hold it back here, it looks pretty big. Look at that.
So it's as big as your head.
It is. Yeah. America does big. That's just the truth. I mean, my buddy mentioned that from Czech Republic, is he's like, man, you just don't get the same size sodas. You don't get like,
right.
And it's so funny because when they came over, they borrowed my buddy's mom's vehicle and it is the biggest. Like, it's like it's some sort of Chevy.
Like an but excursion or something? Or?
It is massive. Like our van is good size, but no. Yeah. This thing, and it was just funny seeing Czech family. I mean, my buddy's from the US, but you know, with his family from Czech, you know, driving around in that thing, and it's like, it mm-hmm. is a boat on wheels.
That's funny. So what's the best coffee you've had recently then?
Oh man, there's this little coffee shop up in Bayfield, Wisconsin, near where my mother-in-law's cabin is that we like to go to. And they had a really good cappuccino there. Nice. So I like that. It's a small roast. I think they roast the beans in Wisconsin.
Nice.
And then they ship it to their few stores that they have. And yeah, it's quite good.
Cool.
How about you?
Yeah, I think I had, so actually this morning, we went down to a part of town where we had done language school for a while, Jenny and I did, and got a coffee at a coffee shop that we used to go to at the break between classes. And I got a flat white there. This has become nice. One of my go-to drinks is the flat white. And it was quite good. But also it was fun. It was fun to be back in that part of town that we're not in quite as much now. You know, we were there daily for several months. And so every other week for several months, but yeah, it's good.
You know what's funny? I just realized I said the phrase quite good like a couple of weeks ago. And uh-huh. Jill's like, you say that a lot now. Like where do you start saying it? Like when did that start? And I thought about it. I'm like, I think I might have picked it up from Steven.
Oh, is that right? Is that something I say?
Like, I think I might have got it from you. So I like it though. It's quite good. Yeah.
It's quite good.
I could be wrong, but I think I've heard you say it quite a few times and it resonated with me. Now and I've adopted it in my own vocabulary.
That's funny.
Well, what's been a highlight for you this past week or so?
Yeah, I think a way that a highlight could be summarized for me was yesterday we had, so every Tuesday we have a team check-in, which is different than our staff meeting. We do that on Fridays, but on Tuesdays we have the team check-in where all of our participants from the site also come together. And we just kind of ask, you know, how's everybody doing? Quick mental health check-in, and usually have some other question related to themes that we care about here. And we had two new interns there and their son, who's two. And then we also have another intern family coming at the end of the week. But just going into that space and feeling that, you know, the feeling of the interns being there and most of the staff being here, we're not quite all back together yet. And then our resident was there and it was like, oh, this is fun. This is fun. And we've been working toward it for a long time. And of course, that's not all fun, but that's absolutely a highlight for me is starting to have on the ground participants that we're working with.
That's great. Yeah. And sure, because there's times where when you're not having lots of folks meeting together frequently, where you probably are just rubbing shoulders with a few of you, right?
Yeah. Well, because two of our colleagues were on home assignment for a good part of the summer. And then the other three staff that are here were all in language school. So there was a big chunk of the summer where I was the only one who was actually in the office a lot of days.
Wow.
And it was lonely. So yeah, this is a nice change.
That's great.
How about for you? What's a highlight?
Well, maybe I'll wrap my highlight and low light together. And I'm not quite sure if highlight is the right way to put what I'm about to share, but I'll clarify what I mean by it. I recently attended the Christian Missionary Alliance North Central District Conference, which happens, once a year.
And is that in Minnesota or?
This year it was in Minnesota. I don't think it's not always in Minnesota, but it was in Elk River. And so Mike was there, a bunch of folks from the college were there and certainly some pastors from the area. In terms of a low light, one thing I was a little disappointed to see was that on the schedule, I think, and I could be mistaken. So if anybody from the district office is listening, they'll say, hey, he's wrong about this, but there may have been some rumblings at some point that the district was considering bringing up some of the matters that are going to be discussed at the next CMA National Council meeting, mm-hmm. Which are matters of doctrine related to women pastoral titles and whatnot. So this relates to what I talked about actually on our last podcast episode. And so there were some rumblings that maybe some of this would be discussed in more detail. And I think some energy was sort of in the air about that possibility. Mm-hmm. And when I showed up, I realized, or we all realized quite quickly, that wasn't going to happen. So that was a bit disappointing.
Yeah, no doubt.
However, what was interesting, and I'm not quite sure I could call this a highlight, but I'll explain a bit what happened. What I learned quite quickly was that the district had decided to invest quite a bit of time instead on bringing in an outside organization to spend about almost three full hours talking about identifying sexual misconduct and abuse in our congregations.
Wow.
And organizations. This is clearly, it's clearly a move that's in some ways a response to some of the recent things that have happened that we talked about.
Yeah, what I talked about last time on the podcast. Yep. Yeah.
And, I know some of our listeners have been really concerned with and actually troubled, rightly so, by some of the district's response. And even there's been some questions about the college's response to that. And I really valued and have appreciated some of our listeners, or all of our listeners who've raised those concerns with us. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that that's on their radar. That's things that they've really been deeply concerned with, because I've had some similar concerns as well. It was a bit surprising to see that they dedicated this amount of time to it. And a highlight? No, not exactly a highlight that they did this. However, I guess my feeling was this. It was definitely not like, aha, see, look at, we've done right after all. It wasn't that. It wasn't like the district is trying to cover their butt by doing something that some purposes of legally covering them. Mm-hmm. That clearly wasn't this. This was
interesting.
Intense. It was an intense outside organization that had some real practical and helpful things. The thing I think I appreciated the most about it was everything they talked about was a posture towards bringing justice to victims, mm-hmm. Was a posture towards protecting the vulnerable. And to be honest, it's not always the sentiments I hear in organizations. Right. Sometimes the sentiments I hear are, let's put policies in place so that we could avoid false accusations.
Yeah, I've certainly heard that.
What this organization was really leaning in on is you should put policies in place to protect the vulnerable. You should put policies mm-hmm. in place. And it had nothing to do with false accusations. In fact, they did a good job of dispelling some of the myths that false accusations are very common.
Awesome.
And so I'm saying this not so that our listeners can get this sense of like, oh yeah, see, the work is done now. No, what I left feeling, and the reason why I might identify it as a sort of highlight, is I left feeling like finally we're putting our foot in front of the other. And meaning like there's steps moving forward. Is this like the actually, end of it? No, this has to be like the beginning,
right? But it opens a conversation with common language and common reference point that
clearly
has been a missing, an underdeveloped conversation. And it sounds like it's a conversation with some foundations that are much better than they might have been.
Yeah. And one thing I think that was maybe one of the most impressionable things for me being, you know, someone in New Testament studies was this particular organization did a really strong job of highlighting a biblical theology of caring for the vulnerable. Cool. That was one of their purposes. And it was, I mean, I've been a part of organizations that will stuff passages just to kind of make their particular, you know, make their particular interest like highlighted in the Bible. This was not that. This was a very legitimate and valid survey and exploration of God's care for the vulnerable. And it set the stage, I think, a necessary stage for the context that we were in to really set the tone, saying that if any of your churches are tempted to think about this in terms of protecting yourself legally, think again. This is at the core, it is a matter of the gospel. It's a matter of our following of Christ. And I think, I mean, I was encouraged, I'll say, by that. So I don't want to be dismissive at all of any of our listeners who are still and rightly still concerned about whether or not some of the steps that have been taken are sufficient and actually not just sufficient, but.
And especially some of the public communication.
Exactly. Yeah. Those are still concerns. So this isn't that, see everybody, see you, we're all doing it right. No. It was a surprise to me. I didn't know this was going to happen. And when I got there, I thought, and after being able to talk with at least one person at the district office, I felt like a move in the right direction. That's about all I can say. Yeah. But interesting and encouraging and also heartbreaking at the same time, that these kind of conversations are needed, but.
And that's where it's your low light also then, is that?
Exactly. So part of the low light was, I showed up thinking they would maybe talk about something and they didn't talk about it. My other low light is.
I got it.
But my other low light is that, man, it's such a heavy subject and it is.
Yes.
Absolutely tragic. In particular, it's tragic that we're having to have it in conversations among Christians, you know, but. Mm-hmm.
But then the highlight is that because it's necessary, it's good that it's actually happening and then happening well, or at least better.
It's the bare minimum of what should be happening. Right. But the fact that it's happening, at least it's an encouraging starting place.
Yeah. I hear that.
So that's kind of a blend of the two. What about for you? What's a low light?
Well, so for sure, we're recording here a couple of days after Russia attacked Ukraine with another round of missiles, and that is there's just a heaviness to that. And and then thinking about people without power here going into the colder months and wondering what the recovery of that looks like. And then also just like, I don't know. I just really want it to be done. And I know that sounds really small in some ways, like I just want it to be done. It's bothering me, you know, I don't know, like, but there's this heartbreak that it keeps going. And it's just like, would you stop already? You know, it's like, watching this thing unfold and just seeing so many points where it's like, this is the wrong decision over and over and over and over and over again. And so there's that. I think personally, I also had this realization this week that so when I've interacted with people who are in roles similar to mine, and there's a whole range of roles that are similar to mine in different ways. But over the last 20 something years interacting with different international workers, I've seen a number of them who have kind of gotten into what I would call, the administrative trap, which is there's just a lot to administer. There are a lot of details to manage. And it was something I definitely did not want to do, that I can do administrative stuff, for a while. I'm okay at setting up systems, but I'm not great at maintaining systems. It's not really a strength of mine. And so it takes a lot of energy for me to set up and maintain systems. And for a variety of reasons related to, where we're at as a site and other things, I'm finding myself doing a lot of administrative stuff. And I don't feel bad about it. I actually enjoy certain elements of it, but I also noticed, like, over the last couple of weeks that I was using very little German. Sometimes my administrative tasks pull me into German a lot, but then other times, you know, it's all in English working with other English speakers. And I think, yeah, just the kind of the low light is looking around and realizing like, oh, I could be right on the edge of kind of moving into that trap. And really, and especially I think in a context where like working with my German language skills, like I tested well at a certain level of competency, but there's further competency that I need, but it doesn't mean like, I still feel a lot of times when I interact with German, I don't feel competent. And so it's easy to pull toward the thing where I do feel competent, right? I can set up a system. I can maintain a system. I can, or I can make myself maintain a system. You know, I can, yeah, work with spreadsheets and numbers and, you know, and all those things to some degree are necessary. That's part of why I got into doing them, but I'm finding myself in this space where it's like, oh yeah, I could get kind of stuck there and I don't want to. And so, yeah, I think the low light is just this realization of like, oh yeah. Okay. I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah. It feels like it can, maybe, and correct me if you think I'm not tracking with you right, but it feels like these kinds of things can go in a couple different directions, right? So that you could, it's easy to sometimes get into a role, especially a role that where you feel a certain sense of calling to, and when the rubber hits the road and we hit some form of struggle with the particular tasks that we have, it's easy again to collapse in on the things we're comfortable with, which is part of what you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. There can be another danger though too, which is, it's not really maybe a danger, but it's an interesting thing that's a fact of the work we do, anybody, is that, you know, if you feel any sense of calling towards your work, so much of it is almost unrelated or just smaller than the big picture stuff that probably has drawn us and motivated us to that particular calling, right? And I think about that a lot with teaching, right? How much of the
teaching is administrative.
I could sit at my desk and read New Testament all day and construct my courses better and
mentor have conversations students.
And all that, like that. Yep. And trust me, we do get plenty of opportunity for that. However, the answering the emails, you know, the getting together and being part of committees, you know, the tasks that, the fixing problems with, you know, your monitors, like
or with small things. With your learning management system, you know.
The grading, you know, and all that. And grading, of course, is a really important part of the college experience, but not something, I don't know anybody who got into teaching. I follow Nick Elder. I don't know if anybody knows him, but he teaches down in Iowa, and I follow him on Twitter, and he's been keen on pointing out that sort of the trends toward ungrading, you know?
Interesting. I haven't heard about this.
Oh man. Yeah. I could point you all to it later, but, so you're onto something, right? But it is an important part, meaning we as an institution have to submit grades. Like we can't not do that. Yeah. But I don't know anybody who's like, man, I've always wanted to teach history. I've always wanted to teach this. And they're thinking, cause I would love to grade those papers. You know, I'd love to grade those assignments. Like,
especially when you spend hours grading assignments then students don't even, I think the most discouraging thing to me with that was I would spend hours grading assignments and then sometimes students wouldn't even know that I'd done it. Like they wouldn't see any of the markup and they wouldn't, you know, it's just like, oh, it's so discouraging.
Well, I've mentioned this even on the podcast before, but I say to students quite frequently, you know, if they submit something that is just complete slop, I'm like, it's going to be that much worse for your professor who's reading it. And I'm like, you know, professors you don't want to get your professors in bad moods when they read your paper, because that's when things can turn real sour.
I did start to like the, I don't remember which system it had, which system had this, but one of the systems that I used, I can't remember if it was, I'm not 100%, but one of the LMSs had a revise and resubmit button and I loved it. You know, it's like, hey, this doesn't meet the minimum quality for me to be able to interact with this paper. It's not good for you for me to grade this. So,
anyway. Well, and I have told students the only thing worse than you writing a sloppy paper is us having to read it. So, and grade it, read and grade.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Andy, I think it's an interesting thought though about calling, isn't it? Because this happens particularly, I think, in the missions field and things like that, where, I mean, how many people have these great visions of, man, I'm going, God's calling me to missions because of this end goal, right? They want to, mm-hmm. they want to impact communities. They want to see, you know, people impacted by Jesus. They want to help a community, you know, who's suffering. They want to see people, you know, come to Jesus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And how much of the work, what percentage of the work is that?
And what percentage of cross-cultural living is just figuring out how to get daily stuff done? You know, like, well, like, for example, we just today, so it's October 12th. We just today finally are ready to submit our 2021 taxes.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Cause they're so complicated and
yeah.
it is not cheap. That's using a tax service that specializes in working with people like us, and it's not cheap. And it took, you know, so long.
Yeah.
And then once that's done, then we have to file our taxes with the German government.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's that kind of stuff that just is like, wow, it's just so much of life is not doing anything that feels meaningful. And that's fine. You know, it's like, that's kind of the minimum thing. I think though, there's another layer of that of like, when the things that actually would be meaningful, are also hard. It can be easy to get good at things that maybe don't matter as much and then to feel good about that.
Yeah.
Like I think, and maybe we saw this sometimes even with, other people who taught, who like they would get good. They would write a really good set. They'd write a good course once, and then they just use that same course over and over again and never update it. And that was easier, but it wasn't necessarily better. I think maybe it's sort of that kind of a risk. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it does. And something I've observed too, this happens here in the States, happens all over, is I've met people where it doesn't take long in conversation for you to get a sense that they have like some, I don't know if I call it ministry or maybe spiritual anxiety, meaning that like, it's like almost every conversation you have has to be somehow brought back to like something spiritual or something ministry related, or it's like, oh gosh, I'm just at home tonight making dinner with the family, and I really need to be out doing something for the Lord. Whereas
there is a, I don't know, I want to say like a holiness in the daily disciplines of living too, right?
No, I mean, yeah, there is, but this is maybe me just getting older and realizing things I could have never realized when I was 20. But I remember thinking so much about how, oh, I just don't want to be that person who's, you know, going through the grind of life. And I'm not saying that I'm going through the grind of life, but like when we read our Bibles, we imagine that all of these early Christians were spending every minute of their day traveling across the Roman Empire and preaching the gospel. And there are so many of them that are living in their towns, working jobs, being faithful to the Lord, to their families, to their communities, and trying to certainly be impactful in their communities, but nothing glamorous, nothing glorious.
Right.
And there's rarely ever even any calls in the New Testament epistles in particular for those people to uproot themselves and go do otherwise. Oh, yeah.
In fact, some of it goes the opposite direction, right? Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life.
Yeah. 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 And of course that doesn't take away from, you know, anyone who like you guys who've uprooted yourselves, and there's, God calls people to do that too, but to think that it's like the paradigm for everybody, or that they're somehow living a life with the Lord is somehow insufficient. I don't know. I've become more content now in the years of thinking about and not feeling the need to have to like overly spiritualize everything or find everything as an intentional ministry, that if I don't bring it back to Jesus, you know, it's like, I don't know. That's just maybe, I'm sure I'm wrong. I'm sure I'm wrong about something in there. So,
Maybe, I don't know.
This is me. This is Justin Winzenberg talking, not Professor Dr. Justin Winzenberg, Professor of New Testament talking. not that I can separate the two, but. Well, maybe I'll count that as my insight then. There's something else I was maybe going to raise, but I think I'll save it for another time.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds good. I think for an insight for me, so this is something that we'll come to on the Unterwegs podcast, I don't know, in a couple of months probably. But it came across this idea today that Celtic Christians had a special word for the kind of disruption that happens when you leave home for the sake of the gospel.
Oh, interesting.
And actually considered it a type of martyrdom, which was really interesting. I had not heard that before. And this is, I'm you know, to anybody who's paid attention to that particular vein of studies, I'm completely obviously a novice, but I just found that super interesting that particularly around the things of missing family, because there was this really high value on family, that being away from family. Yeah, it was considered a type of martyrdom, and actually was considered the most difficult kind.
Wow.
Which was fascinating to me. Yeah, which came at an interesting time. Last night, I was joking around with my family. I've gotten into this terrible habit of reading dad jokes at night on Reddit. And so, I mean, like, I don't know how, usually it's after the boys have gone to bed. And so, Jenny and our daughter are just sitting there like bracing themselves, you know, for these terrible jokes. But one of them, it just made me think of, our family, my extended family has a habit of doing reunions, and at them we do these, no talent contests, we call them. And one of the jokes, I just was imagining like acting out this joke as part of one of the no talent contests. And I had a lot of fun with that. I was laughing a lot, but then there was this recognition at the same time that like, I have no idea when we'll be able to be at one of those family reunions again, and the loss of that. And so I think, yeah, that was interesting to me. I think the insight is, there's a concept that I wasn't aware of, and I find it interesting.
Yeah.
And I'll have to do more work to figure out how it applies to me. But yeah. Find bonus content and more at patreon.com/profsandrooms. We'll be back in a moment with the final conversation about Ephesians. As we jump back into the conversation about Justin's dissertation, I wanted to let you know that we actually recorded this portion back in July, and the release has been pushed back a number of times. Today's release of the episode in the week before the U.S. midterms election is an interesting coincidence. I think one of the things that's really interesting for me in the context that I'm in is I'm thinking about people who were Jesus followers who found themselves in a situation where identification with the political leadership and being kind of in good graces with the political leadership, some Jesus followers found themselves increasingly unable to reconcile their attachment to Jesus with attachment to the political powers. And I'm talking about specifically people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer is probably the easiest example to grab hold of. But of course, there were many, many others, although maybe not as many others as we might have hoped, at least whose names we know.
Well, that's certainly happening in the American political sphere these days, where when various rulings are made or various things are occurring under certain presidencies or not, you get many Christians who feel very alienated by the decisions made by a particular, you know, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat president. So I think similar things are occurring, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe the difference is once a regime becomes authoritarian, that decision becomes more costly. Right, the decision for disagreement. There are social costs outside of that, and that's one of the things that you dealt with in an earlier episode. Is that even when there weren't political or legal
persecution,
right? Persecution types of consequences governmentally that sometimes there socially were, and I think that we can see some of those things. But what does Ephesians have to say to the believer who looks at their political situation and says, I don't know about this? And what does Ephesians have to say to the believer who looks at their political situation and says, hey, we're getting there. We're going to make it. We're going to finally get things right.
Man, that's complicated. I think for Christian readers of Ephesians who are wanting to read it as the scriptures that call them to a certain lifestyle, I think that what it does is it centralizes the work of the Messiah, Jesus, in such a way that should cause us to be hesitant toward too much despair when faced with opposition, and or too much celebrating when it comes to seeing political or other policies put in place that folks feel warranted by or something in their ethics. Because I think that there's something that Ephesians appears to project that shows that there's
a specific danger in putting governmental entities in places that maybe only Jesus as the Messiah can be found to fulfill.
So I think that part of what's so interesting is in some ways it may be easier to look at Ephesians and understand the risk of kind of this false hope, right? This risk of having an eschatology that is linked in an unhealthy way to the success of a political party or a political agenda or other, you know, politicals, I mean, political defined broadly, right? Yeah. So the question of how are we going to, you know, deal with resources and power and what ideas kind of are ruling the day. I think it's easy to look at the critique, kind of this, what seems to be perhaps an implied critique, certainly at least this opposing vision for what the pinnacle of history is. That seems to be pretty clearly here in Ephesians. It's easy to look at that and say, okay, it's easier, I guess, for me to look at that and say, yeah, if my hope is wrapped up in something other than kind of this great fulfillment that's brought through Jesus, then my hope is really perhaps even in an idolatrous place. Right.
Yeah, and I'd be cautious because I think some could hear that thinking that what we're proposing is that some sort of form of Christian morality then is a thing that should be imposed upon societies. Right. When you say, you know, other than Jesus, what we're actually talking about is something far greater, I think, than just suggesting that that's why Jesus needs to be implemented, you know, in public policy.
Yeah. No,
yeah. Okay. I think and that's equally something that should be on the radar, especially if people considering themselves followers of Jesus, is to be cautious of that. And I think what this whole framework does is it challenges both tendencies. Like I said before, I would be cautious to assume that because, you know, Jesus is the one who brings about the pinnacle of history, then all efforts toward justice and society is basically meaningless. I would say absolutely not to that. And I'd say that that's a definite problem, I think, when some Christians go in that direction. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think there could be an equal danger in placing maybe too much hope on legislating the goodness of the world in such a way that causes us to finally resolve the problem between enmity between human beings and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, this gets into it. It gets into really interesting questions like the ones that Richard Niebuhr was raising.
Christ and culture.
With Christ and culture, right? The question of what is, you know, is it Christ over culture or Christ, you know, and culture and paradox, you know, these kinds of different approaches. Yeah. What does that mean? So yeah, thanks for hearing what I was intending and not what I actually was saying. Cause I think,
I knew what you meant, I think, but I think there's just that danger of hearing it as sort of like saying, because Jesus is the one to do that, then that should be implemented in a very particular narrow way in society.
I think that that's actually the opposite of what I was meaning.
Right? I agree. Yeah. I think that's not what you were saying.
Because I think what I, when I look at the attempt to legislate morality in the name of Jesus, so to politicize a view of what humanity should look like and then to implement it legislatively, that if my hope is there in that, then so many things go out the window, right? Like I can't compromise. I can't, winning becomes so important. And the values of Jesus actually would be easy for me to drop because I have to implement, you know, my hope becomes in being successful at implementing what I perceive the agenda of Jesus to be. And I look at that and I think, gosh, that feels like idolatry to me because I'm actually putting my hope in something that isn't Jesus. Is that?
Yeah. And at the same time, we have this dilemma, which is that no New Testament author could have told recipients of these texts what their responsibility is toward voting for various political issues in their government.
Yeah.
Why? Because they didn't have that opportunity. So So this is the difficulty, is that we are living in a different context in 21st century America. I know you're not in America at the moment, but any societies where voting is in place for who is to be in leadership of your government and whatnot, we're in an unprecedented situation compared to that of the early New Testament era. So we couldn't even anticipate what kind of speech acts might have been in place had that opportunity been available to those early Christians. So it makes it a little tricky to try to wonder then what's our responsibility? Is our responsibility different than theirs because our opportunity is different?
Interesting. I think it does raise the question of where is my hope?
Yeah. And that I think we can, you know, I think for those who would like to read the New Testament as Christian scriptures, for personal meaning, for the meaning of guiding one's life, that's a question that is at the forefront of it. Mm-hmm. And yet we still have that dilemma of there's a danger of putting too much hope, but is there also responsibility now that the New Testament could have never anticipated? That's a tricky question.
That is a tricky question. We should come up with a class, like, I don't know, we could call it Faith, Religion, and Political Powers. And
sounds familiar. Yeah, that's right. Did we run that once or twice?
Once or twice. Yep.
You don't remember? Neither do I. Our students who are for listeners might remember better, because they'll maybe remember when being in class with us. But
right. So here's the other side, because I kind of like was holding all that up as one side that I thought was going to be easy, and then it was complicated. So here's the other side, is the side of despair. Because you said you didn't think we should maybe, or something like, I'm paraphrasing you here, something like we shouldn't too easily give ourselves over to despair when things maybe aren't going our way, or don't seem to be going our way. Can you talk a little bit more about that and why you think the eschatological movement of Ephesians would call us not to despair?
It's tricky though, because I want to acknowledge this. Some of this is easier for me to say as a white male, 21st century individual who has been put in places of privilege and even power. And so I may, just to be frank, have less at stake in the political movements personally at times than others. And so I think I want to cautiously say that I don't want to minimize anyone's feelings of despair when something isn't going, when something is particularly feeling oppressive to either their group or to their, or to something that is very personally affecting them.
And so you're not talking here about, oh, my side didn't win and I'm upset about it. You're talking about when there are situations where there's really a disempowering of a group of people, or decisions being made against or on behalf of, in a negative way, a group of people who really lose some of their franchise in that.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be fair, I think, to say, oh, come on, suck it up. Jesus is our true hope. You shouldn't care about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, that sounds very dismissive. It reminds me of our recent conversation with Marcus about how sometimes authority has used truth in that way to really engage in something that is untrue.
And I think to be really we got to be so cautious of making Jesus into the image of what we want him to be, or I like to say, and I've said in the podcast before, the Jesus who's a figment of our imagination. Right. I mean, all Jesus is always our figment of our imagination, in the sense that we can't think of Jesus without imagining. Right. But what I mean by that's also
true of our friends and family, right? Like,
yeah, it's exactly what I mean is merely a figment, which means the Jesus of our own creation. Yeah. And I think a danger is that we then end up, and this has certainly been the case in some Christian circles, we end up depicting a Jesus who doesn't care about earthly justice. Mm. I don't think, the more that I read the New Testament, the more I think that Jesus doesn't match the Jesus of the New Testament.
You're saying that Jesus that doesn't care about justice doesn't match the Jesus of the New Testament.
Correct.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't want to minimize the desire to legislate justice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think what's getting so complicated is it just seems like, especially in the American, this is just kind of maybe getting off topic, maybe this is for Patreon, but in the American political system, I'm just not sure anyone can agree on what justice is.
Yeah.
And I think that's the dilemma. And I'm not saying, see, justice is as easy as saying, just read the Bible and it'll tell you. Like it's a very complicated thing, even among Christians who agree on the same text and yet do not agree on this interpretation of those texts. And so I think, oh man, it's a very complicated issue. I want to say that that the despair that's felt about a society that is continuing maybe oppression or continuing to move in a direction that is feeling like it's affecting someone very personally is extremely real. And I think though that there is, this is without trying to minimize that, some hope that Ephesians offers in particular of a hope that transcends that despair while not minimizing it.
And I think that's, if you take seriously the context of Ephesians, right, which was one of the first things that you were trying to do, there certainly may have been readers it seems likely that in the implied audience of Ephesians, there were people who would have felt similarly disenfranchised. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, some most definitely would have. I think post-colonial interpreters, not just of the New Testament, but post-colonial theorists have shown in general just some of the despairs of empire in general. So I think, and those are very valid things to take into consideration. So I'm not sure you can have empire without disparaging peoples.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, I think, and again, what does empire mean? And are we identifying Rome as an empire the right way, even though it's kind of the most standard way that we talk about it? I think there's good reason to say yes. And that the folks doing work in post-colonial studies is showing some of the concerns with that. Now they also would raise some of the concerns with, is it possible to challenge that mode of empire while also using its and playing ball in its terminology? So when I talk about, you know, Ephesians talking about the shedding of blood and the cross and all that, I think some post-colonial interpreters would be disturbed by that, by saying you can't challenge one empire and then sort of replace it with what they think is another. Mm-hmm.
What do you feel like? I mean, I feel like this project, you know, you spent, 10, you have spent something like the last 11 or 12 years in this project.
Well, I think because I just submitted its final form for publication and it should be coming out here in August. I mean, if my math is honest, I think I'm maybe closer to around 14 years.
Okay.
13 years or so that I've been working on this project in some form, not always in its content, sometimes just in polishing its formatting, but I've been ruminating on it for longer than I ever thought I would. And by the way, that doesn't mean it doesn't have weaknesses. Because it took this long with it, it's perfect now. Now there's stuff now even that I'm like, oh, I wish it could change this, but I'm like, I can't get into this editing mode or it will never be done.
Right. So. Yeah. And recently we had a conversation that I think maybe is ending up on Patreon, but you were talking about not wanting to have this be the only thing that defines you as a scholar, right? Like this is not, you're not intending for this to be your life defining work dissertation. Never is supposed to be that, right? But I think, you know, as you look back and as you look forward, what do you hope to take forward from what you've learned in this investigation of Ephesians?
So I had an opportunity to answer this a bit on the Two Cities podcast, which should maybe even be out by the time that this releases. But and there I answer it more related to the question of Ephesians and empire scholarship. But here I think one thing I'm reflecting on is there's so much that a project like this does, I think, to try to challenge one's own beliefs, one's own perspective on the Bible, while at the same time giving you a great deal of humility, knowing that some of these issues are very complicated. It's just made me feel it's okay to have convictions about what the Bible means while also holding it very loosely in some ways, understanding that there's so many things that we maybe are missing and so many things that we haven't considered about these texts. It's, I think, why I get so frustrated continually when people, especially in certain sort of religious circles, certain Christian religious circles, just kind of keep pounding into people that, yeah, but the Bible says, yeah, but the Bible says. I don't want to diminish the fact that sometimes when the Bible says, the Bible is very clear about what it says.
Right.
However, I'm never very satisfied with that Bible says approach. And we've talked about this, I think, before on the podcast.
Well, and particularly the risk of really meaning, well, instead of meaning, well, the Bible says, meaning, well, the Bible, as I read it, says, right? That's kind of the actual meaning, even though that's not what's communicated.
And sadly, I think with almost any text, the Bible can say whatever you want it to say. I'm not saying it should say whatever you want it to say, but it certainly can. And so I think there's a danger, no matter who you are in reading the Bible, because we bring so many of our own experiences. It could be experiences of trauma in religious context. It could be experiences of great liberation and feelings of spiritual renewal that we bring to our reading of the text in such a way that can sometimes just color it in such a way that maybe misses some things. Mm. And I don't want to be dismissive of either, right? I don't want to be dismissive of those who experience some trauma from their upbringing. Now they can't hardly read the biblical text without feeling a sense of abrasion, right. You know, like it's scarring them continually. I think my encouragement to those might be that sometimes maybe the problem isn't the text. Sometimes the problem has been the interpretive communities in which you've been traumatized by. And then for those who I think are just looking for it because they're spiritually invigorated by it, I certainly don't want to be dismissive of that. There's so much to gain from the reading of the scriptures that bring this spiritual vitality. It is the, I think, best source for finding spiritual vitality for those who associate with Jesus. however, sometimes that seeking that in the text can lead to also us missing some things that I think could enrich and enliven it and cause us to be more compassionate and loving towards others. So yeah. I think that's what it's taught me a lot about is a great deal of humility. And you've heard me talk on this podcast and elsewhere of ways that I think I do feel confident in reading the text. However, one thing that you want to be careful of is also ensuring that here's where I lean. Here's what I think is most plausible, but I understand that there's so much more I could be missing. And I'm saying that as someone who has an opportunity to do this for a living and to read the text frequently and constantly engaging it and hearing other perspectives on it by students and colleagues. So it's something that stands out to me.
Yeah, no, that seems really rich. I think in some ways it's an unsatisfying answer in the sense that sometimes when you look at the world around and it just feels like kind of unstable, it's like, I just want, like, could this be more solid, right? And I think that sometimes there's almost a hermeneutical drift that can happen because we're trying to just be certain of something. And I think that there's maybe some epistemological problems with that. You know, the idea of certainty is something that I've tried to help other people wrestle with, something that I've wrestled with myself, that maybe certainty isn't what we're called to. And I think definitely even just looking at the question of what faith is, that it's the assurance of things not seen, right? That there's this sense in which I think probably faith feels often a bit unsettled, and that when we move into certainties that sometimes we've actually moved away from faith. And that in some ways is intellectually, not where I want to end up. Right. I also think in other fields of knowledge that's often where we end up as well. Right. That actually the more we know something, the more we kind of come to this conclusion of, okay, so here's what, as best as we can tell, here's what it is. And then here's the list of caveats. Here's the list of all of the things where it's like, okay, but if we really know this, we also know that here are all the limitations to the thing that we're knowing. And I don't think that has to be a source of discomfort. I think it often is experienced maybe as discomfort, particularly in things of faith. But I think it maybe is a sense that we've wrestled deeply with something that matters. I don't know. I think for me, having walked with you a little while you were working on this project before it was completed, and then now getting to kind of walk through it, I think what I love about the question that you've brought to the text is that is a question that is important from a hermeneutical perspective of saying, okay, what was actually happening? Who was writing and how do we interpret who was writing and who were they writing to and how do we interpret who they were writing to and what was happening in the text and what level, you know, locution, illocution, perlocution are we paying attention to and how do we tie all those things together with the context and that it's this kind of rich and deep wrestling and then bringing in questions that have so much importance for how we would apply the text today. And I think what I love about that is that if the Bible matters, then it should absolutely be able to stand up to that kind of wrestling with it.
Sure.
And I think it's a fun, somewhat scary, a little bit, maybe almost dangerous sometimes project, but I think it's one that, yeah, if approached in humility and not from the perspective of, hey, I've figured out how I can tell you all that you're wrong, but instead to say, here's some questions that I think are worth asking. Gosh, what a fun and engaging process.
Well, and I think one thing I'll say is that I wouldn't recommend this avenue for a lot of folks, but there's something about ruminating on a subject for 13 years that causes you to see and ask questions. Like, had I finished this thing 3 years in, it would have looked way different, way different. Now, had I let it linger for another 13, which is impossible for PhD, but just even for say publishing it, it would have looked way different as well. But I think that there, you know, one thing maybe that I learned about it, and this is interesting, is we have very little attention in the modern world for extensive study of anything. Mm-hmm. And I am absolutely privileged to be in a spot where I can do that because it's also part of my work. And I know there's so many people that's just impossible to do, but it says something about, how might our thinking be shaped in certain ways, if we ruminate on subjects for longer than what we're used to, and even ways that cause our viewpoints to change. Because when I set out for this project, I had some thoughts about maybe where it might go. And I remember there's been so many times where I teetered back and forth about the anti-imperialness, imperial criticalness of these passages. And I think that's a good process to go through. So for anyone who's a reader, especially of the New Testament, I'd recommend to try, if possible, to ruminate on subjects maybe longer than you're comfortable with. Maybe it can yield some interesting learning experiences.
All right. So let's go the complete opposite direction. What is your dissertation in 140 characters or less?
140? Was that Twitter or what?
Yeah. That was the old Twitter limit.
My dissertation explores whether or not Ephesians challenged the ideology of the Roman Empire.
Oh, sorry. What's the conclusion of your dissertation in 140 characters or less? Yeah.
Yep. In fact, I think it's actually on the back of my book, something along the lines of this. While there are limitations to the to an imperial critical reading of Ephesians, after looking at speech acts, it is plausible that some of Ephesians' speech acts challenge Roman imperial ideology.
Nice. All right. Well, listeners, you
close. Can... Close. It may not be 140, but it's got to be close.
You can type it up and send it to us and let us know how many characters that was.
There you go. Yep.
Cool. Well, thanks for walking through this. We may do a couple more episodes here and there. There are a couple of super interesting parts of your dissertation that we didn't even touch, which is hard to believe because we spent a long time talking about it.
But we could probably be on this forever, where I think it's maybe we probably got to start moving into looking at your work because I think it'll be very interesting to do that.
Fascinating. I'm maybe more comfortable being on this side of the mic, so we'll see.
Yeah, I totally understand that. That's not it. Once your own work gets kind of scrutinized a bit, or you have to start re-articulating it. I've had the benefit of working on publishing this, so I've been dwelling in it, even though I finished it, where you haven't been dwelling in it probably as much.
No,
so
I can see it sitting there on the shelf, but I'm going to have to re-engage it here.
Yeah. It'll take some refreshing, won't it?
It will. Yeah. Well, thanks for being willing to walk through it with us.
Good luck on the edit. Good luck. Cool. Well, I'll catch you soon here.
Yep. Sounds good. Thanks a bunch.
Yep. Right. Bye.
Later. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. In our next episode, we talk about beauty with filmmaker and professor Jonathan Vinson. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.